Welcome to Knitting Networks,
the podcast about social network analysis.
I am Francisco Ortiz Ruiz.
And my name is Alejandro Espinosa Rada.
In this podcast, you will find interviews, reviews, and other conversations about the complex world of networks.
Join us to look into the history and the last theoretical and methodological developments of this scientific perspective.
Okay, welcome to another chapter of the Knitting Network podcast, or Tejiendo Redes in Spanish. Today we are talking from Poland. We moved to another country again, and we would like to start the interview. If you can present yourself to our audience, it would be great.
Hi, so my name is Michał Bojanowski, and I'm an assistant professor at Koźmiński University in Warsaw. And also a researcher, technically it's a postdoc, at the Coalesce Lab at the Autonomous University of Barcelona. And I'm a sociologist by training, but probably somewhat unconventional sociologist, but probably we'll get to that later.
How was your first approach to networks? How was the first time that you hear about this world, or maybe you read it, or maybe it was someone that actually showed you this? How was it?
Yeah, so actually, when as I was recollecting my thoughts yesterday night before we meet, I was trying to recall that actually this whole story which was very interesting experience to me, because I realized that actually I never thought about it earlier, to kind of retrace these steps. And I think I have a relatively windy academic road. So I guess I perhaps stumbled upon some examples of network models, really, not really empirical analysis of network, but some network models. I think these were block models. I had an elective course during my master's program in sociology, which was about mathematical models. And this was, I think we were mostly going through some very basic classical applications of mathematics to social sciences based on some results, let's say, ideas from 50s and 70s, so Markov chain processes and all sorts of stuff. And the instructor also gave us an example of a block model as a way to study. So if you have a network of relationships between some people, and you can use block model to group them. But to me, this was totally abstract. I didn't, at the time, didn't really see any kind of real application other than a kind of a toy mathematics example and so on. So it didn't really push me to do anything with that new knowledge. But I think this was the very first time that I actually saw anything like that. So I guess it's also important to realize that this was in the 90s. So I was studying in Poland, this was really before the internet really became a big source of information. So I think people were much more intellectually isolated at the time. So especially in Poland, so Polish universities even didn't have, access to online journals and all these things, so it was very difficult to get your hands on the current literature. So it's a kind of a context, I think, which is also important to remember. Actually later I took a deep dive to networks when I enrolled with my PhD program. So I didn't know anything about networks. I was mostly doing quantitative, like classical quantitative social research with social stratification questions, mobility and inequality questions. But I was doing that during my master program and also After I finished my master's, so I was lucky enough to be well, not recruited technically, but I was working with big survey projects in Poland. So with PGSS, it was like a kind of a clone of American General Social Survey. And then later, this was at the University of Warsaw, and then later in Polish Academy of Sciences in POPAN, which is an ongoing, actually ongoing panel study since 1988. So I was mainly around these classical sociological questions and quantitative methods around those. And I had a kind of a crisis in the sense of being dissatisfied with this whole endeavor, in a sense, I lost interest, and I was looking around to do something interesting. In a sense, where should I look to further develop academically? And I remember now that I even made this sort of self-commitment that either I find something that will interest me, or I will have to look for another job outside of academia, essentially. So in a sense, okay, if there's not much more, then I think I should do something else totally. Because during my studies, I was mainly interested in game theory and decision theory, in the sense of what I liked about those ideas was that they were well, at least from what I was learning during my master program, among the things I was learning, so there were the things that to me were the only theories that make the, you know, the social actor a kind of a proactive, really an actor that's, you know, an agent that does something, and it's not only a subject to social forces, like a passive subject to social forces, but actually tries to, you know, achieve some goals and so on and so forth. And but the way I was taught, the way game theory was presented to me was totally a normative way, in a sense that, okay, these are the prescriptions how people should behave in interactive situations, rather than explaining something. Mm-hmm. So, and when I was looking for, okay, when I was in my dissatisfaction, I was looking around, okay, I should do a PhD, and I should do it abroad, not in Poland, but abroad. And I found research by Vincent Buskens from Utrecht in Netherlands, who was actually doing just that. So he was working with game theory, but in an applied manner, in a sense, trying to use it as a theory that is to explain macro phenomena, but not technically macro sociological phenomena, but to explain something observed. So his papers were really something like, wow, so I didn't know that people do this. I should really get into that. And I remember this was in winter, and there was a deadline for enrollment for a PhD program there in spring, I think. So I just applied and I get in, I was very, very lucky. This was a turning point for me when I look back at it, because it's a very competitive program and very good, of course. So and this turns out to be that's how I entered into really networks, because this was about understanding how networks form, how people behave in networks, using game theory, right? So in a sense, I was not really this was my interests were not really about network data, although now I kind of went back to that, circle around. So I'm now doing more research in about how you model network data rather than doing pure theory. And my thesis was actually half of it was theory, and the other half was more empirical. But yeah, so that's a kind of a long story of how I got into networks.
Amazing. And actually, you mentioned in the beginning yeah. that you are a sociologist, but maybe not so much, like you were doubting a little bit. Is something related with that?
Yes.
With the different progress that you have done, or?
Yes and no. So when I mentioned that I had a period of being dissatisfied, in a sense that I had a kind of a dissatisfaction, meaning that social science is a kind of a intellectual endeavor that nobody agrees about anything. So in a sense, there's okay, so we can't agree, social scientists cannot agree what they think they know, at least at this very moment, and what are the big questions. I think if you would ask social scientists what are the big social scientific questions contemporarily, they will probably not agree on a well specified set. And this is, of course, very difficult because you meet different people and it's like, So I was dissatisfied with that. And so in the meantime, just to deal with this, I was trying very different things. So, for example, I studied musicology for 1 year, just to do something else. Yes. So musicology, maybe it's worth explaining. It's a kind of a history of art, but not visual, but, aural, right? So I don't think you can study in many places in the world, but definitely in Germany, because I think it's actually a German invention as a musicology as a field. I had various moments during my career of that kind that in a sense, okay, I have to do something totally different. That's why I think it's not a kind of a career in which you start something, you find something interesting, and then you stick to it for 50 years or something. Yeah. I don't wish it to anybody, actually. I think it's nice to look around and actually work with many other people from many different fields and so on.
Yeah, well, the field of networks is very interdisciplinary. So that's really cool too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, yes, very true. Exactly. Yes, exactly that.
Do you have any researchers that actually inspire your work?
This was actually also a very interesting exercise to think about it. So of course I have people who are very pivotal for my intellectual, yeah, not only academic but intellectual development through my work, and this includes both a professor who was my master thesis supervisor, Grzegorz Lisowski from Warsaw. He's retired now. So I actually took all his courses he ever was given during my 5 year study. So and these were about decision theory, game theory, social choice theory, and inequality. And statistics as well. And it's interesting because they gave me very, very good fundamentals in all these things. At first, I remember I was not very happy because I didn't have a kind of a feeling that they enable me to do something, in a sense that, okay, they give me tools to do research. That was not, I didn't have that feeling. But the funny thing is that now, like 20 years later, all these things come back to me, sometimes even subliminally, in a sense that I think his teachings also showed me what's the difference between good research and bad research, in a sense. So it's like he's a perfectionist, so in a sense he was really leading by example, which sometimes is actually not good, in a sense that you should not work on a problem indefinitely, in a sense that you should always frame it in time, right, in a sense, because otherwise you may work on a single paper for, I don't know, But on the other hand, of course, it's part of the fun of being an academic and researcher is actually that you have, that you can do things well and that are, say, well thought through, and they are make them beautiful and so on, in the sense that you have the time to make such things. But anyway, so he was one of the persons I mentioned, Vincent, already. So he was my daily supervisor in my PhD, in my PhD program. But I have two other supervisors who were also important for me during then. So this was Stephanie Rosenkrantz. She's an economist in Utrecht, because the PhD project of mine was part of a larger project, which was actually led by Vincent and Stephanie. So this was like sociology cross economics. And Werner Raub, who is also a sociology professor at Utrecht. And so they really taught me how to theorize. And this was actually very interesting. So lots of people, I guess, again, different people have different points of view about that. But I remember I entered the PhD program with very strong technical skills and in statistics and in data analysis after all my years, two or three years spent working with people from those big survey projects. But I had a kind of a theoretical void, so to speak. And I was also, from my MA studies, I had a kind of an experience of that what people do is they take a basket and go shopping for theories when they analyze data. So they have the data, and then they go shopping for theories to find something that will explain their data. And this to me was not very, I didn't like it. To me, it was on the verge of being unethical. My stay at ICS and working with Vincent and Werner really showed me actually the value of theorizing, and actually that to some extent, maybe it's even not an exaggeration, that when you do science, it's actually the theory, it's something that it's ultimate goal, in a sense that it's that you want to develop an understanding of something that you can communicate in words, right? And of course, you can recite the values of regression coefficients or something like that, but this is not that. So they were definitely very important for me to think about and to value theorizing. The other group of people that influenced me in that sense was the Martina Morris and other people from the StatNet group who work with exponential random graph models and other ways to statistically model networks. So these are the interactions. Actually, I spent 2 months in Seattle with Martina and Mark Hancock then. They probably may even not remember that too well, because I was very short time I was there. But anyway, this exposed me to all sorts of things that I didn't have really an idea about back then. And we collaborate until now. So actually, I'm StatNet member since a year formally now, so that's a great group to be a member of. So I really also enjoy what both Martina and Pavel Kritsky and Carter Batz research. I always look forward to their new papers. If I would think about inspirations, these are definitely people who influenced me the most during my development as an academic. And of course, there's a whole army of people whose research I really cherish and value and always find interesting in reading. I think big name here is James Coleman. Which is actually interesting because I sometimes have a feeling that he went through a similar intellectual development in sociology that I did. Namely, he started very in a quantitative manner. So in his first book, which was the, I'm not sure it's the first of us. So he wrote an introduction to sociology in the 60s. It's called Introduction to Mathematical Sociology, something like that in English. I remember I had a, it was translated into Polish, which was really a kind of, I don't know, somebody had an epiphany to do this. So this was one of the very few books about mathematical modeling in social sciences that was translated to Polish in the 60s. So I have it. And this is very, 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 it's mathematical in the sense, it's old school mathematical in the sense of mathematical slash statistical. So you have Poisson models of different processes and so on and so forth. And then he made the transition much more to thinking about social processes and actors in this kind of semi-economic way, which is close to how economists do this, but not quite, I guess, partly because of his Coleman's was giving a seminar to together with Gary Becker for some time. So I think they mutually influenced each other. His the foundations of social theory, so that his Opus Magnum he wrote later. This is a book that I very often go back to because it's almost like the prose of Thomas Mann. If you had an occasion to read this, so in a sense, you can study a page of a 700 pages book in a sense and always find new ideas there. So that's something that's I guess the other inspiration I have lots of inspiration from natural sciences, when I was thinking about it, I think these are the last two people I'll mention. It's Richard Feynman and Richard Dawkins. I think social sciences still wait for their Dawkins in the sense of a person that is able to communicate to the public all the things that we were able to find in the social sciences, but were not smart enough to sell well, bluntly, or to explain it in a way that will show that this social sciences are both exciting and useful and so on. So I think Dawkins did that for biology in general. And both of them, I think, right? So Feynman is no longer with us. So they were great teachers. So it's an example. I think that there are two, Feynman especially, I think. He's a top example for me how to communicate complex ideas in a way that they are approachable and simple to understand, but not simplified. Feynman was a genius in that. That's why I like to browse through various textbooks on all sorts of things, not really to learn anything, but to see how people do this. So how people communicate all these complex ideas. And so, which is actually funny because, for example, Ulam, there was this famous mathematician, he was Polish actually, and he worked in Manhattan Project, and he is quoted by, I believe, Samuelson to say that, so he was messing around with social scientists, and so he is said to be asking social scientists, so please give me an example of a social scientific theory that is both complex and true. And of course, Samuelson was not very happy because he couldn't give an example at the time. And I think a lot of perception of social science in the public is just that, in a sense that it's either false or very simple or not complex. And I think this is not true. And the problem with the statement is not true. And the problem with that is essentially that we still, I think, again, are waiting for social scientific Richard Dawkins. And there are people that are, who are getting close. I think Duncan Watts is one of these people. So I really like his books. But yeah, more would be better. So yeah, sure. these are I think the people when I, that I think of when I think about inspirations.
Let's talk a little bit about your current research. It would be great if you can tell us a little bit about what are you doing right now, or maybe if you are in different projects, you can also tell us about different ones. This is the moment in which we want to know about what you're doing.
Right, yes. Yeah, so all sorts of things. I get probably too many things at the same time. So primarily I'm working with Miranda Lubers at Coalesce Lab in Barcelona. So that's Miranda got an ERC grant, and we are going to do a cross-national survey in Europe. The whole project is about social cohesion and study it with network scientific tools. So social cohesion understood actually it's an unclear, under defined concept in a similar manner that social capital is. So in a sense, again, different people would understand differently, but all there are, as you say, different types or forms of social capital. And it's the same with social cohesion. So it's a kind of a macro social feature in which this dates back to Durkheim, a macro social feature of a society in which everybody finds perceives his place in society as a good place. In a sense, everybody is satisfied, and people collaborate with each other. People feel identified with the group they're part of. So in a sense, it's a kind of a stable state of happiness of everybody, in a sense of being happy with the social positions they occupy. There are more aspects to that, but I guess it's not very interesting now to go into this. But the thing that I particularly find interesting in that project is the type of data that we want to collect, which is data about different types of social relationships, so types of social relationships which are both close but also distant. So Miranda developed a very interesting idea how to collect data about acquaintanceships, which is a kind of a hybrid between the so-called network scale-up method, which was originally developed to count to measure sizes of hard to count populations, such as, I don't know, drug abusers or homeless and so on. Use it as a kind of a first to estimate. So using this method, you can estimate essentially how many people a person knows by name. That's, of course, it's a matter of the definition that is used in the questionnaire, but by and large, that's the whole idea. And you can use it as a way to actually generate alters in the very similar manner as you generate alters using the traditional name generator. So it's an egocentric study in which we want to have alters which are both close and also distant. This such collected data, which will essentially be a fuel to both network modeling. So in a sense, we want to understand how these different types of networks look like, how they interact and so on, but also to be able to create some sort of artificial societies using this information. And I mean by that generating networks that can be further studied using, for example, agent-based models. And we have people, Yunsu Li and and Nigel van Harwijnen, who will be doing just that. So I'll be primarily doing here the something which is actually one of my main interests at this moment, which is modeling networks based on partial network information. So in a sense, the setting is that we don't have a complete information about the network. In a sense, we don't know the state of all the dyads. It's not a network census. And we want to understand essentially why certain dyes are and some others are not, right? So in a sense, how the network looks like. But it's not feasible to collect data on all dyads, so we have to resort to something like network scale-up method or egocentric designs. And it turns out that actually you can do quite some inference using that, not without assumptions, but you can do this. So that's the type of techniques that we'll be applying there. So that's the patchwork project that I work on with Miranda. I have also two historical networks projects. That's something that I found very interesting couple of years ago, and started working with historians, which is for me this is very interesting because so it's also kind of a clear example of collaboration, in the sense that it's a collaboration as a synergy. So there are people they know very well, for example, the archival material they work on, but they didn't realize or didn't have the tools that you can actually apply network methods to understand what's going on with those. What kind of social process network that the archives actually represent as a kind of a network process that can be and these methods can be applied there. So I'm working with Agata Bloch. She's a historian from Warsaw, on networks of correspondence between officials of Portuguese Empire. So this is based on 160,000 documents that cover the period of 250 years. The big question there, that also inspired me, is whether essentially by studying the evolution of that network, can you see how the colonies of the empire become more and more independent politically and economically. So whether through these archives, is it possible to see the evolution of the state, right? So these are not social networks in the sense of networks of citizens. This is a kind of a big scale organizational network analysis in the 17th century, right? So, and this whole organization that is the state, the crown, evolves, right? So and the letters that are part of this corpus are very different. So these are petitions, for example, to the king. There are letters to governors, governors writing the king, complaining about pirates, and all sorts of things. That's the other project, the historical network project. I'm also working with lawyers from University of Warsaw. They are studying papyri, right? So these are the documents from the I don't remember now. I probably would lie, but this is something like 200 BC from Egypt. So actually, among historians, it's a very well-known place called Aphrodita, which is a city in Lower Egypt. And I think in the early 20th century, they essentially totally by accident found a cellar full of papyri. And it turned out that the house belonged to a local lawyer 2000 years before. And what among those papyri are all the legal documents. So this was the lawyer, I'm not sure what's the English term for that. So essentially he was writing down all the contracts for their village. For the whole village, so you have the archive of all the so it's wills, all sorts of things. So you can even, you should essentially map almost the whole village and economical relationships between the people who live there. Also, there is a monastery there, which was a big economic player in the sense that it controlled a lot of land that he was leasing to other people who was living in the village. So all sorts of things. But what's important about that, what's the main question in this project, and that's what also Maria Novak, she's the leader of that, they are interested in. It's also something that I find very interesting from the sociological perspective. So essentially, this is about bottom-up roots of the law. So in a sense, the question there is that, because there were no well-codified ways in which how you write contracts. So people were developing all sorts of, you know, contract rules on the fly. And the question is, so, okay, if we have two parties contracting and the one is much more powerful, for example, it's a monastery, are they able to enforce all sorts of contractual solutions there just because they can, because the other guy has no alternatives? Right. Yeah, so this is like, so from the sociological perspective, this is very close to, you know, social exchange theory and power dependence theory and all sorts of things, which unfortunately lawyers are not trained to learn about. So these are all sorts of, you know, ideas that actually can be applied there. So that's also something very, very interesting. Yeah, and the last thing I should mention is, so I'm an R developer. It's almost 23 years now that I use R. I mentioned that I work with StatNet people to develop and maintain all the packages within StatNet, which are the, I guess, the main, one of the main, if not the main, implementation of exponential random graph models, which are around and definitely within the R ecology. And I have some couple of packages I wrote on my own. Some of them are for network research. So one is about with network segregation measures that accompany a paper I wrote some years ago with Renzo Korten. But also all sorts of other small tools to help people work with their data, which I always found very engaging in a sense that writing software, I mean, because it's I recently looked at my profile at Google Scholar and I noticed that actually the packages that I wrote, they are indexed by Scholar, Google Scholar as well, next to, you know, normal publications. And some of the packages are actually cited more often than the papers I spent a year writing, right? So yeah. So that's something actually it's also kind of underappreciated often in academia, namely that, say, software is not really perceived as something on par with scientific publications. Which, on the one hand, you can argue, okay, but somebody developed an idea and I just coded it. That's of course very often true. But on the other hand, so for example, pieces like StatNet were developed for, I think it's since the early 2000s, right? So it's again almost 20 years since the early ideas, and the amount of intellectual, you know, effort and time also goes beyond writing papers, also because you have to maintain it in a sense. Okay, so you created it, but then it's a lot of work to keep it operational, right? Yeah. So I hope this will change at some point, namely for example, funding agencies will also be more willing to fund software, research software development, because nowadays this is very difficult because you can get a research grant, but you can't really have software development there because, well, it's not research, right? So, which is true only in the very narrow sense of the research, right? So I spend a lot of time writing packages as well and helping others learn R actually as well.
Yeah, I actually appreciate that comment about not appreciating too much the developing of this kind of tools, because exactly, yeah. In productivity, in academia productivity, the whole concept is about publications and maybe conference presentations. You have really strict ideas of what is productivity in general from the institutions, but then
yes.
You have these other things that take so much time, but actually maybe they have more impact in the community sometimes. So
yes, exactly. So yes, exactly. So it's like, I don't know, if you have a publication that was cited, I don't know, let's say 100 times since in the last 10 years. And then I have a package that that is downloaded 100 times a day. Of course, part of that is our automatic systems that download these packages all the time just because some other package is being tested. But I mean, in the sense of, you know, people talk a lot about impact. I actually don't like this term, but that's a different story. But if you think about, okay, how useful it is what you do, then definitely writing packages and then get responding to emails from people who try to use it for what they do, actually, for me personally, are much more rewarding than yet another citation to a paper I wrote. And there's a 15th citation of a paper I wrote some years ago. And it's the same with, say, I don't know, I have a package for making some peculiar types of graphs, I mean, data visualizations. And it was also very much more rewarding to me when I saw a figure made by my package in Nature. So in a sense that you can do, you know, top scientific publication and somebody used my tool to make this graph. And it's far better than if he would cite some my paper because they read my abstract, right? So in a sense that it's, I think, I find it much more rewarding. And of course, it's a kind of an illness I have that is, I like to make things. So make things that work. So, and packages are just that, right? So it's not like, it's a kind of an idea that is constantly working. It's not something that you write down and it's written and it's kind of dead, but it's something that is living almost.
Yeah, that's true. So let's talk a little bit about conferences, about Sunbelt conference, or maybe the European one, whatever you prefer. I would like to know which one was your first Sunbelt conference. How was it? How was your overall experience with the conference? Or in the last years, how has it been?
Yeah. That's very interesting. So my first conference was not the network conference, I remember. So this was a year after I finished my master's, and I went to an RC28 conference. RC28 is a research committee on social stratification and inequality of the International Sociological Association. But my first network conference was Sunbelt, and this was in Corfu in 2007. And this was the beginning of my second year in PhD program, and I was essentially presenting my first paper for my thesis. I was very stressed, but on the other hand, I had great memories, because I remember we went there with the whole group, and we had a great time. So I don't really remember much from this conference in the sense of talks of others, although I always try to think about, okay, so what was the big idea of that particular Sunbelt? So you always, I almost always you have one. So like I have a personal presentation that I think personally was like a big thing on that conference. And I don't remember that one from that much from that any of that from that particular one, and of course, well, I'm sure you all noticed that too, that these conferences are getting bigger and bigger, which is which is nicer from one perspective, in a sense that there are more and more people interested in networks. On the other hand, I'm a bit of an introvert, so I don't find myself very well in big crowds, and I think that's also the case with Sunbelt. That's say early Sunbelts were kind of conferences that are party size, so to speak. That means that in a sense they are small enough that you can almost have a chat with everybody there. At least you recognize everybody, and it's a kind of a party size conference. So this year I was in Ars in Ischia. It's a small network workshop, well, small and growing network workshop in Italy. I remember I was there also some 10 years ago or something. So this was a kind of a party size conference in a sense. I mean, on paper, there were almost 100 presentations, but it's still on order of magnitude smaller than Sunbelt, which has thousands or something. So what I want to say is I usually prefer those smaller events, especially that those in which that attract good people, and because you have more interactions, there are more slow paced, less anonymous, and so on. But I try not to miss Sunbelt. So of course, COVID was something else, and I didn't go to Australia yet, but otherwise I try to be on every Sunbelt, primarily because we teach workshops with StatNet Group. So that's always something that we always do. I think I even once went for Sunbelt just because of the, so I didn't have a talk myself, but just because of the workshops. So I go to, and I also yes, so USN of course is another one, so the European Social Networks Conference, and actually this year I think is the first year I will not go, so it's an exception.
Yeah. So if you had to choose, which would it be your favorite network, if you have one or maybe two? I know sometimes it's tricky because you need to choose one, but I don't know, if you can try the exercise of thinking of one favorite network, what would it be?
Yeah, so I have a favorite network in the sense that it's an example that I always use in give, I don't know, classes to students, regularly a workshop about using iGraph for SNA. It's a network I always use because it's perfect for just that, for explaining ideas and all sorts of ideas. It's perfect because, first of all, it's small, and second, it's relatable. It's a network from a classroom of 24 kids, and I know everything about that network, of course, because I use it for like 10 years now or something. So there are 24 kids, 12 girls and 12 boys. They are 9-year-olds, and there are all sorts of features in the sense that you have weekly and strongly connected components. There is a high segregation, and so and actually about every node you can almost say tell a story. There's also an isolate who corresponds to a boy who was essentially absent for a long time because he was sick, so he has no ties. Unfortunately, that's a very sad story. The network comes from a study done by Professor Roman Dolata in Poland, which was a big study about, not about networks really, but about essentially educational attainment and what's and about it, an extent to which the school matters in educational attainment. So in a sense, how, to what extent the variation in students' outcomes is explained by schools, right? So to what extent the schools matter in that sense. But somebody again had an epiphany to add name generators there. So there was not a lot of written about that. And it's a very nice data set because there are more than 300 school classes, 6,000 kids. So that network, it's essentially one classroom out of those 300, which is, again, as I said, for all these reasons, very pedagogical and not too big and relatable in a sense that everybody can imagine what it is. The dice correspond to, so that the kids were asked to name other kids from the class with whom they like to play with, right? So this is a clear positive relationship. So it's very nice to talk about networks using that. So in that sense, I could say it's my favorite network because I use it all the time.
I have one last question for you, which would be about your opinion for the next steps of the community. Like, in your opinion, which are the next challenges that the community has to confront in some point in the future?
Yeah, that's actually very interesting. And that's actually also very nice because we loop around to thing that we talked about earlier, whether to the extent to which people in the field agree on something. So I guess, so you have this, problems in natural top 10 problems, the million-dollar prizes for solving problems in natural sciences. And for some reason, we don't have it in social science. But again, I have two challenges come to my mind from the purely substantive point of view. So like big research questions. And these are, in my opinion, first of all, understanding spontaneous group formation. So going beyond how networks form, to think about how teams form, for example. So if you put together a group of people in the room and they are confronted with a kind of a task which incentivizes collaborating, how can we empirically, so there are a lot of models, mathematical models and cooperative game theory models about that. So we to understand what kind of groups or coalitions, as they are called also in game theory, you can understand to what extent how they will be beneficial to its members. But I think there is a lot of unknowns when you ask a question, okay, but how does it happen, right? Mm-hmm. So how these larger, not diets, right, as you have in traditional social network analysis, how these groups appear and why, and it will be great to have a models for that can be applied to data. So in a sense, okay, can we model this using an empirical model, not purely theoretical model? So I think that's, so when I think about these problems, I think that's the biggest one. So that you have various ideas nowadays. For example, I know Per Block and Marion Hoffman on working on these, and I'm following that very closely. So that's one thing. I think if somebody comes up with something like a practically estimable ergon, because of course you can come up with all sorts of ideas, but then the problem here is that essentially the space of possibilities that you have to traverse in order to have an idea whether the configuration you're trying to explain, how likely it is given all sorts of features. The problem is that the space is huge, much larger than for conventional networks. So that's a kind of a computational challenge there. But I think there are lots of theoretical challenges here in a sense to understand, okay, is this group formation should be understood as a kind of a pairwise driven process. So, okay, we have two people, they make a team, so they look for a third one, or then the fourth one. Is it growing like that? Or is it like snaps and we have groups, right? Yeah. Anyway, so that's one thing I think it's a kind of a pressing question to me. And the second one, not unrelated, is working with big networks. And by big, I mean society scale. Also trying to understand or model why they look as they do. So of course there are some research on this as well, so, or even the whole books by Tom Snyders and others, and by the group from Slovenia, Vlado Batagelu and others. But I think it's also a lot of questions here. And again, both theoretical in the sense that, okay, it's not feasible to assume that the whole network of, I don't know, 30 million Polish citizens develops using by the same rules. But if there are different rules, how what's the proper way of, you know, they combine and so on. And so that's both theoretical challenge and also, of course, a kind of a practical computational challenge in the sense of how can you work with such big data, right? Essentially, because it's not only storing and computing on a network with 30 million nodes or something of that order, but also, I mean, when you want to understand some process, you have to think counterfactually, right? So you have to think about, okay, why this network looks like it is, compared to other alternatives. And of course, enumerating or at least traversing these alternatives is challenging because it's, of course, there are so many. So yeah, so there are, I think, two substantive challenges. And of course, there is one community challenge, I think. So of course, we have there are people doing social network analysis, which have social scientific provenance, and you have network scientists, people who study physics or computer science, and these are unfortunately two separate communities. And there was supposed to be a union conference in Washington 2 or 3 years ago, but COVID came. And it happened. So this was a joint meeting of Sunbelt and NetSci, but unfortunately, because of COVID, it was all online, and it's such a pity because I was actually looking forward to that, in a sense of even though it will be a huge conference, so yeah, even more anonymous than the standard Sunbelt, but it would be very interesting to have, you know, big names from both fields to meet and discuss, which didn't happen because it couldn't because of COVID. So I think it's a kind of a challenge to find common grounds and bridges between those two communities. And I hope something like that, again, the joint meeting, for example, will happen in the future.
Thank you so much for the whole conversation and for
Thanks.
The opportunity to just be talking about this stuff. So looking forward for reading more about your current work, all those projects. I'm really looking forward for that.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
This was today's chapter. We hope that you enjoyed it.
Remember that the first Wednesday of each month, we will publish new chapters.
Also, you can always send us suggestions and ideas to our emails.
We hope that you heard us again. And in that way, we can continue knitting network.